Welcome to this edition of When the Biomass Hits the Wind Turbine, a discussion of sustainable living and what that means to you and me. I'm Jay Warmke.
I'm Annie Warmke.
You are. And today we're going to talk about some regulations surrounding sustainability issues, or you've got to understand the rules before you can break them, right?
You know, I say that on every tour. I learned it early on in my career as an activist, and that has served me well, but it really served me well, building an airship and trying to deal with lots of different kinds of people.
Mm-hmm. Well, one of the issues, and I think this goes beyond sustainability, goes almost to every aspect in our lives, but it seems like the system is set up to make whatever you do wrong, you know? I mean, Am I being paranoid? I feel like everything I'm doing, I could get arrested for at any moment.
Well, the first problem was you married me, so that was your first act of revolution, but
They haven't come for me in the little
No, but I don't think it's paranoia. I think the reality is that there are lots of rules set up. That's part of bureaucracy, and we are a bureaucracy, and people have to remain employed within that bureaucracy. And so that's why we have to understand what are the rules, and then we have to decide if what we want to do is important enough to try to figure out how to get past those rules or bend the rules or break the rules.
Well, when you mention a bureaucracy, I always think about in bureaucracies, every single rule makes perfect sense. But when you put them all together, it's complete absurdity, you know?
Well, I think that's a fairly broad statement. I don't know.
It's my philosophy of life.
Okay.
Every statement makes perfect sense. But in combination, they're absurd. Okay.
Going to remember that.
All right,
that.
So let's talk a little bit. We'll start with shelter because, you know, when we talk about the things you need to live, and sustainability is all about living. You know, you've got shelter, you've got food. We have a whole episode on the food issues, but you know, then there's also water, energy, some of these others that we'll touch on. But let's talk about shelter first, because one of the things that's very popular at the moment is the whole idea of tiny houses. And tiny houses, almost from the beginning of their concept, have been going against rules. You know, these rules come down and they say, okay, you're not allowed to build a house smaller than X. In some places, it's 700 square feet. Other places, maybe 400, other places, 900. But these laws, covenants, building restrictions, whatever you want to call them, come in and say, okay, you want to build a tiny house? Well, already we're going to make that against the law. So that's an issue. Yet, so what people have done to get around that is they've said, all right, I'm going to put wheels on this thing, and I'm going to call it like a mobile home. And then they come through and say, okay, that's fine. But you're not allowed to live in mobile homes. You know, you're not allowed to live in trailers, RVs, whatever it is you want to call them. So it strikes me that it's like one rule after another that's just designed to make this concept of living minimalistically illegal.
Well, I think I really don't know that that's the case. I think it's an issue of that people worry about people like us, and we're not exactly
as well they should.
That's right, because we are not exactly the people that are going to go along and live like other folks. We've tried it and it didn't work for us. But I think it's more than just about tiny houses. It's as we grow into an age of renewables, which is where we're going right now, and there's not going to be any stopping it. The real challenges are about zoning and how it applies to reusing materials. So, for example, it's not just about tiny houses on wheels. There's always been bigotry around poor people and rules that we're going to keep poor people out. And, you know,
right.
But what I'm getting at is like those truck beds, you know, truck containers, mm-hmm. cargo containers. So those are being used actually in the main part of London.
Right.
They build an apartment complex there with those. But again, it's going to come down to the fact that we have to deconstruct buildings, and then we're going to reconstruct buildings with some of those materials. And right now, zoning laws really are prohibitive in doing any of that process, whether it's a tiny house or a cargo box or, whatever. So that these are the challenges, the regulations that exist, and they are unique to every, practically every block of every neighborhood, township,
well,
county.
Well, we've run into that before, where on one side of the street, this particular practice is illegal. On the other side of the street, it's encouraged. You know, it none of it makes logical sense. As we said, when you put them all in tandem with each other, it's all kind of crazy. But we were discussing this before about smaller houses, and you were saying, okay, well, if I lived in a suburban neighborhood, I would prefer not to have these little tiny houses.
Well, I would fight against it. You'd fight
keeping them out.
Yeah, I would keep them out because that neighborhood is not set up.
And I would be picketing
tiny,
in front of your little.
You would not.
In front of
You're
your McMansion.
You're so full of baloney. But I'm just saying that if I lived in a cul-de-sac neighborhood or a housing development neighborhood, or any of the, you know, neighborhoods like in a small town, those neighborhoods are not set up for tiny houses. And so if we really want to have a tiny house neighborhood or a tiny house village, then we need to design it accordingly because it's going to have different needs. And the reality is, if we want to be minimalistic, which is the premise of tiny houses, we should be demonstrating that across the board and not asking the mainstream to comply to us and say, well, we're going to move into the cul-de-sac area that has, you know, McMansions or $200,000 homes or whatever, and expect that we're going to change things there. If we really are doing this because we want to be minimalistic and we want to change how things are being done, then we should be going out and finding ways to create these little communities so we can demonstrate how to share, how to grow food together, how to deal with waste together.
Well, and I think we're in agreement on most of these issues.
You and me?
I know. Yes, you and me, nobody else. But, you know, because one of the things that just sort of gets my hackles up is with regulations, with any kind of rules, we come up with these rules. It's like a one-size-fits-all thing. Tiny houses are an example of this. We don't want small, you know, poor people, basically. It is always legislating against poor people. We don't want them coming into our neighborhood.
Even though some of those suckers cost $100,000.
Right. So we say, okay, we will prohibit this from happening by restricting the size of the house, when the reality is restricting the size of the house has no effect on those issues that perhaps are underlying it. We want these things to comply with the feel of the neighborhood. Well, a small house can do that as easily as a large house. We want them not to be shabby, run down. We want them not to be polluting. We want them not to be...
Well, then they should be going after some of the houses that are already existing in the neighborhood.
So that's my point, is restricting the size does nothing to address the underlying justification for restricting the size. Just like when we talk about, you know, prohibiting raw milk. You know, it really is unclean practices that you're trying to deal with, not raw versus pasteurized. That's just one solution that they came up with to try and address the underlying cause. And then we get married to this solution. So, okay, we're all in agreement. Tiny house restrictions on the face of it is silly, but that somebody trying to put some home that doesn't fit in a neighborhood, regardless of its size, is... maybe not good. I mean, there are reasonable restrictions.
Well, it would be the same if you look at neighborhoods that are really gentrifying right now, which is happening all over areas in bigger cities. They're coming in, and there are a lot of these neighborhoods where they built what they called GI Bill homes, and that the government to provide for the veterans when they came back from World War II. And housing was real limited because those guys had gone off to war and they were, you know, just out of high school, and they came back and they were ready to go to college and have families. And so there was nowhere to live. So they built these little tiny story and a half houses. And now this is a lot of the housing that's available in these gentrified communities. So people are buying up two or three of those, tearing them down and building huge houses right next to the little tiny GI house that's next door.
Right, and we could make the same argument that that doesn't fit in the neighborhood.
No, that's
so
right.
There should be no homes larger than 2,000 square feet.
Absolutely.
That rule. Somehow I don't think that's going to fly through city
council. No, but that's the way it works.
All right, well, let's talk, you know, a little bit about these restrictions. They're usually through building codes or whatever. And we get a lot of people out at Blue Rock Station who kind of have this idea of sticking it to the man. I don't want any rules governing my life. I'm kind of one of them often. But then
you want to stick it to the man? You care that much?
But I want them to leave me alone most part. But for the most part, these rules exist for a reason. So if you are talking about wanting to build alternatively, you should go and talk to these people. For the most part, I think they're reasonable folks. Say, what are your concerns? How can I address these concerns? And hopefully you can come to some sort of accommodation. That would be the first step.
Well, I'd also ask for it all in writing, because sometimes these places, that person's been there since they got out of high school, and sometimes they make their own rules. And I want to see under the revised code of that state and that county and that trustee or township, I want to see in writing exactly what those codes are. And then are there possibilities for exceptions where you could pay extra money and it would go back to the state and they would consider if they were going to give you an exception for different things like waste treatment or or the size of the building or whatever.
And a lot of times they're worried about, you know, everybody loves to say we're setting a precedent. And I always say, well, you set a precedent whenever you get up in the morning. But if
well,
you
the
can
law
give
doesn't
them,
look at it
I
that
know,
way.
But if you
Nobody
can give them an
that.
Excuse, you're an experiment. You know, maybe you can get set up as an experiment. In fact, that was sort of the solution I recall Michael Reynolds did out in Taos, you know, as far as one of their developments. They finally got an exception saying, okay, this is an experimental location where we're going to try these techniques. And this was around airships and building.
Right, but
tires.
That would be a very good example of how you, because he didn't start out like that. He broke every rule and he didn't care and he rubbed everybody's face in it. He ended up losing his architectural license. So in my school of thinking, it's like, let's go educate ourselves on what that local person who's over the law says, and let's look at what the law in writing says, and then let's go back with a plan that tries to incorporate some of their wording into your project. And things like what you're saying is that maybe we have a project where we want to demonstrate, a demonstration project that shows different ways that we're going to use these things. And then we can also show that it's not a precedent. We're not doing something for the first time, because that county over by New York State or whatever, and so it's on the borderline of Pennsylvania and New York, and they are working together to do something similar. So we want to show that they're not setting a precedence. Maybe in that particular state they are, but in other municipalities or other regions they aren't. So we want to play the game as best we can. And if we really want to change things for the future, this is what we're going to have to do.
Right. And nobody ever got fired for saying no. You know, all these regulators and the like, you got to give them a good reason to say yes.
I got fired for saying no a couple of times.
Okay, but this is not Me Too here. Okay, that's a whole different issue, okay? So anyway, so we talk about these alternative building techniques, and some of them that are alternative become fairly mainstream. But this is not a new issue. Like straw bale, for instance, is pretty well defined in the international
Straw bale's been around since the
forever.
Beginning of this country.
Well, one of my favorite things around alternative building is the story of the cave dwellers of Pennsylvania, you know, when they came over during colonial times and actually found that it was much more comfortable to build into an embankment to hollow out a cave and then build a facade of a home over the front of that cave, because of the thermal mass, and it was quite comfortable. And then William Penn apparently got teased when he got back home in England about his people were living in caves, so he came back and made it illegal because it was not British enough. You know, so of course everybody had to freeze to death in these clapboard houses because the climate here was not the same as England. So it's just one example of regulations that are, I think most of the time it's because people are being teased for, you know, all of these weird hippies wanting to come into the neighborhood and dance around maypoles in tie-dyed T-shirts or whatever. I mean, that's their concern.
Well, one thing to consider, too, is that you have to have a building permit. Now, not everybody requires that. I know when we built our first building, we did not have to have a building permit. But you're going to want to know if that's the case and how you have to display it and get to know the person that's going to come and check you out. Invite them for some coffee.
Okay, well, you are listening to When the Biomass Hits the Wind Turbine with Jay and Annie Warmke, reminding you once again, it is indeed the end of the world as we know it.
And thank God, Jay.
Thank God. All right. Well, today we're talking about regulations around, you know, sustainable living. And we've been hitting on shelter, haven't even talked about the silliness around lawns and not allowed to have gardens in your front yard and things like that. You know, it's almost like the legislation oftentimes encourages and mandates practices that are actually harmful, like lawns, you know. I mean, and it really favors the aesthetic over the sustainable. So let's just take that as a truism. And then let's talk about water.
Oh, well, what I was going to say, though, is I think lawns are a very good example of how corporations have really been in control of at least local government for quite a long time, because lawns are the largest crop grown in the United States and the biggest polluter in the United States. And yet it really produces nothing but something that has to be mowed off by law in most locations. So lawns are really a frivolous, crazy thing, and I think we brought that with us when we came here from other countries, and it somehow makes us seem like we are rich or whatever.
Right. It was originally an expression of wealth. You know, I am rich enough to have all this land that has no practical purpose other than
or
to
no
be
sheep grazing on it.
Yeah, yeah, to be ornamental.
Yeah, so it's really crazy, and it contributes greatly to lots of the ecological problems that we have. Mm-hmm. But then there are laws against growing food.
Yeah, and growing gardens in your front yard, you know.
Or even maybe your backyard.
Yeah. Well,
what are you going to do? And also, but there's a growing movement around that. And at some point, it won't be able to be stopped. But people are also keeping rabbits and chickens and even goats in their yards. And they're doing that because they want to be able to determine the food quality that they're ingesting with themselves and their families.
Okay, well, let's talk a little bit about water, you know, because water, probably more so even than shelter, is the stuff of life, right? So when we have our tours at Blue Rock Station, and people will always be a little bit marveling at the idea that we're drinking rainwater, and we always go,
they always
well,
say, well, where's your water come from? And you say, the sky,
yeah.
And they're like, what?
You can drink rainwater, and it's like, well, you're drinking Mountain Dew. I mean, geez, you know, I mean, you talk about weird stuff. But anyway, so the reality is, in most parts of the nation, not all, but most, the rain is fairly clean. I mean, it's a natural filtration process. And yet our systems are designed, well, there's two really weird parts of it that I think about. First off, why is drinking water and all other water treated as the same utility? Because you don't need to have drinking water to flush your toilet. I mean, that's sort of a...
You mean drinking water quality.
Yeah. We filter this stuff. We chemically treat it. We bring it through. We pump it for miles and miles and miles to put it in a toilet bowl and flush it, and then it goes back miles and miles and miles.
Well, I think it's habitual because we started out drawing water from the sky to have inside of a building, or we pumped it from the ground, and perhaps it was just too complicated to figure out how you're going to make that do two different things. And I will say that in the early days of house water, people had a pump just for hand washing and face washing and their
sure.
bathing. And then they had separate water pump for everything else.
Mm-hmm. Well, it's partly because we've allowed government, or we've encouraged government, to take over the management of our water systems.
Well, everything, you know? Cradle to grave.
I mean, I remember as a kid, I mean, there was always, it was almost like Christmas, you know, the idea that they might bring city water out to our neighborhood, you know, because everybody had cisterns and everybody had septic tanks. That was their
Or a well
water.
With iron, high level of iron. That was
yeah.
horrible.
But then the idea of city water, boy, oh boy. And then city sewers, oh my God. I mean, those.
And the taps were free because they wanted everybody to to tap into the line.
Well, and now we're seeing the government's not that good at maintaining these systems.
What it's do you mean thing, not that good? That yeah. Some places you risk your life to right, consume right. that water.
So then, so let's say we want to be a little more sustainable about this. We know we can harvest water out
I just
of want the
to
sky.
Say the government in some places doesn't even care. In the city of Detroit, they were more concerned about the GM factory having the right water because it was corroding the materials when they were building the vehicles. So they turned one switch and they gave GM factory clean water, and everybody else 4 years and some months later is still dealing with the poisoned water.
I am shocked that you feel that our government caters to corporations over the
individuals.
It's owned
all by right. them.
Okay, so anyway, gray water disposal, rainwater harvesting. So we have these two options. I'm going to stay on target, Red Leader. So anyway, so we can harvest rainwater, except some places don't want you to. You know, there was
it can be illegal. I mean, even to just bring it into rain barrels and use in your garden can actually be illegal.
Yeah, Colorado is notorious on that. You know, they did restrict the harvesting of rainwater. The claim was that it was a public utility, that if you harvested rain, you were basically stealing from the public utility, which is strange in concept anyway. And then the science, of course, shows that almost none of the water that falls on your home finds its way back to the aquifer that is, in fact, drawn from for public consumption. So it was a fallacious argument from the get-go. But for whatever reason, they decided to hold to it. Now they've loosened it up a bit to say, okay, now you can gather up to 110 gallons, but you can only use it for gardening outdoors.
So that would be 255-gallon barrels.
Yes.
Well, let me say that I think what we're coming to is the fact that there, at some point, is going to be a critical mass of people who are going to be doing this differently. And it's going to change the rules, whether people like it or not, whether mm-hmm. the government likes it or not.
Well, it gets to that. If you're breaking the rules, if everyone's breaking the rule, you know, then
there's not enough government employees to come after you.
Speaking of medical marijuana, right?
Well, the other piece, though, is that it's not a matter of we should be doing this to live more sustainably. We are going to have to do this kind of thing where we collect water and we harvest rainwater, and we have the ability to reuse that water so that once we've taken the shower, we can also flush the toilets with it. It's just the reality, and whether the government likes it or not, or corporations like it or not, this is where we're going. And the train's picking up speed, it's going downhill, and it's the way it's going to be.
Well, okay, as far as gray water disposal, I think no one would argue that you should not be dumping, you know, toilet water out on your lawn, unless you happen to be raising pigs, and then you're allowed to do it,
apparently. Oh, I don't think you want to do that either.
I know. We don't want to. But this gets to the point, like up in Minnesota when we were working on a project, and they restrict gray water disposal. They did not want
so let's gray say water. Gray water is just water that from when you wash your hands or wash the dishes or take a shower,
right? Pretty much everything.
There's no poop or urine in it
except from your toilets. Yeah, so mm-hmm. shower water, mm-hmm. laundry water, and dish water. They restricted that, and their argument was that trace amounts of fecal material would find their way into this gray water and be dispersed.
What, it's alive and crawling along looking?
I guess. But anyway, so my argument to them was, do you own a dog? You know, trace amounts of fecal. I hate to break it to you, but you know what? The world is full of poo.
Even if you don't have a dog, other people do, and they let them poop
right,
in your
right.
yard.
But then at this location across the street was literally a 30-acre hog septic
pond. A fluid
pond. Yeah, just 30 acres of open sewage. But you're not allowed to drain a little water. This is where one rule doesn't understand what the other rule is doing, and none of them make any sense. So we have those kind of issues.
I want to point out, though, that the difference is that that pig farmer met with the inspector, and that inspector was able to tick off every single box
sure.
that was required. And the person who was spraying the gray water onto their lawn, which actually gray water is quite good for plants because it kills bugs and it adds nutrients to the soil. That guy didn't have an inspector who came with a list, and so therefore he was breaking the law. And that's really what it comes down to, Jay.
Yes. Okay. Well, if that is the law, as Shakespeare said, right, then the law is an
S-O-L.
Ass. No, the law is an ass. All right, so let's talk about the composting is another issue, something that everybody looks at with sustainability. And there are literally laws around how you can compost stuff, which is kind of...
Well, there should be, because if you're just throwing it out in your backyard, you're going to attract a whole lot of things you don't really want.
Well, the average home, apparently, according to statistics, I looked this up, 474 pounds of organic waste, of compostable waste, for food scraps, just
every
food scraps.
Year every or year, every week?
Every year per person. So so that's a lot of stuff. And for the most part, when I did look into these composting regulations, they seem pretty reasonable. Things like you should be set back from the property line like 3 to 10 feet. There were height restrictions of the composting.
Like the compost is too tall.
You didn't want it to topple over and kill somebody, you know, buried under a pile of, you know,
something.
I was going to say tomato rinds, but tomatoes don't have rinds.
No,
what am
thank
I talking
you
about?
For correcting yourself.
So anyway, so some of those seemed to, and then something that just came up in our own lives here just recently, which got me thinking of the silliness of restrictions, but burning, you know, burning lawn waste, things like that. I know burning.
Well, that's
anything
not
in
silly.
Concentration.
I mean, people have lost whole towns
right,
from people burning something.
But the restrictions are such that it's like anyone who has ever burned anything in their backyard is violating the law.
Well, I don't get it because it says you can't burn it at night.
No,
I mean,
it says
at
you
the
can
daytime,
burn.
And but you can burn at night. I'm thinking, but at night you can't see.
Right, and the months that they restrict it, at least in our area, are actually the wet months.
Yeah.
Where, you know, at the very little risk of the fire going beyond. Okay, so
unless
water.
Unless it's you in charge of it.
Well,
and then there are too many stories to tell with the time we
yes,
have left.
Yes, when it comes to burning yard waste, these restrictions are well intended.
For you.
And right on
point. I think it's
point.
Called the J bill or something.
Yes, somebody was watching me. All right, so then we get into some energy. Like, again, the big ones with solar and wind. Restrictions that exist there, we see wind especially, and it's in the news again because our beloved president decided that wind causes cancer or whatever. And so there's restrictions where they've setback restrictions, tower height restrictions, noise restrictions. All of these things are typically intended to inhibit the development of wind. And they do this where they don't do it for other things, like cellular towers, things of that nature. Solar is another one that's kind of annoying in that often they restrict the ability for people to put it, you know, on the front of their homes where it's visible from a neighbor.
Or I mean, like if you wanted to park your car under it, if it's visible from the front, you can't
right.
do it.
Right, and you saw that in France where...
Yeah, where the church doesn't approve of it.
Okay, well, I think we put that one to bed. You have been listening to When the Biomass Hits the Wind Turbine with Jay and Annie Warmke. We want to thank our producer, Adam Rich, and we want to thank you for spending just a little bit of time with us. And as your grandmother hopefully told you, without restriction,
play nice with others, clean up your own mess, Jay, and for heaven's sake, eat those vegetables.
Okay, I'll eat them. Till next time.
Mother Earth will sing and her children will be
You can find more information on living sustainably in our unsustainable world at BlueRockStation.com.